Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of September. The U.S. military command of the war in Iraq changed hands yesterday, and we'll be talking about that change. The country has also witnessed a significant drop in violence. We'll ask the question why. Also in Pakistan, the military yesterday said troops would fire on foreign forces if they crossed the country's borders, but they said that this was not a change of policy. The comments came after the U.S. sent commandos into Pakistan to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda earlier this month. We will talk about that. We'll also look at Afghanistan. And who better than to do all of this than Fawaz Jurjis? It's been a while since we've talked with him. He, of course, a leading expert on the Middle East, terrorism, and energy policy. He has been for some time now interviewing activists and militants in preparation for his forthcoming book. He holds the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. He is the author of many books, including The Journey of the Jihadist, Inside Muslim Militancy, and The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global. He has spoken widely on the Middle East, on television and radio networks throughout the world, on NPR's Morning Edition, has joined us frequently, and has written extensively for Foreign Affairs, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Christian Science Monitor, and the list goes on. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Jurjis. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or feel free to send an email if you'd like to do that, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Fawaz Jurjis, hello. How are you? I haven't talked to you in a while.
I'm just fine. Good morning to you and to your listeners.
Good morning. It's great to have you on the air. When is the next book coming out? I'm anxiously awaiting it.
Well, I'm you know how books are. They're extremely difficult to write. I think I'm hoping to be able to complete the book by the end of the fall.
Uh-huh.
That's my goal, but you know how it is.
Right. I know, and there was a lot of preparation. You talked to people all over
Absolutely.
The Middle East
I mean,
for this.
The most difficult part, really, Kathleen, is to write the book, to be disciplined and selfish and... and as a teacher and a family person, time is very precious.
Yes, there's a lot on the plate. The U.S. Yes. military command changed hands yesterday. Is that significant?
I don't think so. I think both generals have been in Iraq for quite a while. They represent a very close knit team. I think the big question to me, and the new general made it very clear yesterday, he said the situation in Iraq remains very fragile and easily reversible.
Mm-hmm.
Very fragile and easily reversible. And I think this is a very accurate portrayal of the situation in Iraq. Yes, violence has decreased considerably. The number of people are killed, American soldiers and Iraqis have has decreased quite a great deal. But Kathleen, remember, we're talking about almost 500 Iraqi civilians killed on a monthly basis, even today.
Mm-hmm.
Just this week, two major suicide bombings have killed scores of Iraqi civilians. Iraq now Baghdad is a walled city. That is, it's been ethnically cleansed. The various Iraqi communities now live in separate compartments. Sectarianism is very ripe. The Iraqi government remained a very sectarian-based government. The political crisis has not been resolved. In fact, I would argue the political crisis between the various Iraqi communities remains as deep and as wide as it was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, now we have a new fault line between the Sunni Kurds, who are trying to establish a sovereign, autonomous region, and the Shiite and the Sunni Arabs. And this particular fault line might easily explode and plunge Iraq into another major crisis in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, I was listening to a report on NPR this morning about the Sunni Muslims being paid by the American government something like $500 a month to not fight. How significant is that in terms of a drop in violence? Is that a major reason there is a drop in violence?
You know, Kathleen, this is you're putting your finger on a very important question here. If you listen to the Bush administration's argument is that the surge, the so-called sending 30,000 more troops to Iraq, basically did the trick. That sending more American troops basically played a key factor in the decreasing of violence in Iraq. I think this is nonsense. It's nonsense. I think the critical factor was not just sending 30 more thousand American troops, but was the revolt of what I called Sunni Arab tribes against al-Qaeda's vicious attacks in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So the American surge of troops coincided with the internal revolt by Sunni Arabs. Sunni Arabs have been leading the insurgency in Iraq and basically brought about a major decrease in violence. And when we talk about the Sunni Arab revolt, we're talking about 120,000 Sunni Arabs who basically hired by the Bush administration and being paid between $300 and $500 a month in order to chase out al-Qaeda from Iraq. But what you have now, yes, the violence has decreased as a result of this particular new development, but you have 120,000 at least of fighters, trained and seasoned fighters, who are being armed and financed by the United States, who could represent a major headache for both the United States and the Iraqi government. And in the last few weeks, there has been some major skirmishes and clashes between the so-called the Awakening Councils, or the Sons of Iraq, so those Sunni Arab tribesmen, and the Shia-dominated central government. In fact, they have threatened to take arms both against the Shia-dominated government, the al-Maliki government, and the Kurds, who are basically positioning themselves to get one of the largest and richest cities in Iraq, that is Kirkuk. So it was not just the surge, as the administration would like us to believe. It was basically bribing tens of thousands of Iraqi Sunnis, and those Iraqi Sunnis could easily turn their guns both against the American military presence and the Iraqi government. And that's why, as long as the political situation remains fragile, Iraq remains a highly dangerous situation, as the new American general put it very aptly yesterday.
Mm-hmm. 120,000. I had no idea the number was that high, being paid $500 a month, plus you're bailing out Wall Street. Where's the money coming from? It's going to run out, isn't it?
Well, Kathleen, this is not just about, remember, the administration now is celebrating the decrease of violence. Fine, it's fine. We're delighted. We're really delighted that fewer American troops are being killed and fewer Iraqi civilians are being killed. Even though, Kathleen, for your listeners, when we say 500 Iraqi civilians are being killed on a monthly basis, this is a large number. But what the administration does not tell the American people, it was its strategic blunder in its first place that basically caused the United States to lose more than 4,000 American fighters, troops, and over 30,000 injured, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians, not to mention, and this is to answer your question here, that we have spent so far in direct money almost $1 trillion.
My goodness.
$1 trillion, Kathleen, and according to some of our leading economists, the indirect costs would exceed $3 trillion. Our monthly bill, even today as we talk, as a result of the administration war, is about between $10 and $12 billion a month, while the American people are suffering on a daily basis. And this is what the administration does not want to really tell the American people. They want to talk about the decrease of violence, not about the costs to American life and Iraqi life as well.
Mm-hmm. General Ray Odierno, in the transfer of power yesterday, did say that Iraq is becoming a more sovereign nation. It's going to take on more of the responsibility, and it's my job, his job, he's saying, to make sure that we are able to do that in a very smooth way where we don't fall back. What do you think?
Iraq is not a sovereign nation. Iraq does not have a national unity government. The al-Maliki government is basically was put in place by the Bush administration. All the major decisions are taken by the American authorities and the Bush administration. In fact, the irony, Kathleen, the irony in the last few weeks, it was the American-based government in Baghdad which has exerted pressure on the Bush administration to basically give it more responsibilities and to set a timetable for pulling American troops out of Iraq. It has been the Bush administration that has been opposed to granting more sovereign rights to the Iraqi government. And in fact, both the Bush administration and Senator John McCain are coming to the same position as Senator Barack Obama, who has been making the argument in the last 2 years that we must grant the Iraqi government more sovereignty. We must establish a timetable. And this has really forced the Iraqi government to take responsibilities and bring our troops home. The debate now, the debate in the United States now, is that the surge has succeeded. While both the Bush administration and Senator McCain should tell us why both sides now are coming to the same position as Senator Barack Obama, who made the argument 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What about this withdrawal of 8,000 troops by early next year? What do you make of that?
Kathleen, this is a joke. This is a... Now, after the withdrawal of 8,000 troops, we have now 140,000 troops. That is, as many troops as before the surge. With the 8,000, to your listeners, the administration has decided to continue its policies as they have been since the invasion of Iraq. Reliance on military force, not trying to extract American forces from Iraq. It's the same policies. And in fact, it's the Iraqi government and Iraqi officials who are very pro-Bush administration, who are basically urging and pledging and exerting pressure on the Bush administration to pull more American troops out of Iraq, to set a timetable for pulling American troops of Iraq. The irony is, the administration says Iraq now is, you know, a much better place. Fine. If we accept your premise that the situation is stable, that basically the Iraqi government is sovereign, then why don't you accept what Iraqi officials and politicians would like you to do? Set a timetable for pulling American troops out of Iraq, grant the Iraqi government its sovereign rights. But of course, the rhetoric is one thing, and the reality on the ground is another thing.
Mm-hmm. We, as you know, Professor Xerxes, have talked about this issue before we ever went into
many
Iraq.
Times,
We've talked
times.
About it for years now. Here we are, a presidential election just a few weeks away now, and yet this particular issue is not something that you hear the presidential candidates talk about that much, nor the American people. Why is that? Why do we let this go on so long without figuring out what path we need to take, and why have we seemingly lost some interest in this when it doesn't seem to be going very well and we're paying a phenomenal amount of money to keep it going?
You know, Kathleen, we must remember that our fellow citizens are really going through a very, very difficult situation, economic situation now. That the dismal economic situation has done a great deal of damage to millions of Americans. I'm not just talking about the oil, I mean the gas prices, I'm talking about unemployment, I'm talking about medical insurance, I'm talking about the working class, the shrinking of the middle class. And that's why I think the so-called America's multiple wars have receded in importance. This is point one. And secondly, historically speaking, at the end of the day, voters vote domestic politics, in particular the economy. So we're not surprised now that the economic issues are gaining the upper hand. And thirdly, you see what the Republican Party has been able to do and what the administration, the Bush administration has been able to do, is to really shift the debate from basically the strategic blunders committed by the administration and the tremendous costs in life and treasure to the United States and Iraq into, well, the surge has succeeded. You see, instead of debating why are we still in Iraq, instead of debating why the strategic blunders that has basically bled
American economy to a certain extent. Now we're debating, I mean, Senator John McCain is celebrating our victory. He does not tell us what's victory. If the leading American general still says today, after so much, I mean, resources and cost, that the situation remains very fragile and resistible and reversible. So what's the victory? Can he define the victory for us? And I think what the American people need to focus on is not whether the surge has succeeded or not. I think the surge has partially succeeded, but what has succeeded basically is the internal dynamics within Iraq, is basically the costs that we are still paying in Iraq, both in life and in treasure. $10 billion is a huge bill. And any American voter must take into account when he thinks of Iraq, is it worth it? To what extent should the American taxpayer money still pay for a situation that remains very fragile and reversible, while the Iraqi government now basically urges the U.S. government, the U.S. authorities, to grant it more authority, more sovereign power to set a timetable. No one is suggesting we should pull out overnight. Senator Barack Obama is saying he will he would responsibly end the American presence over 2 years. I think that's exactly what the Iraqi government wants. And this is, in fact, exactly what the Bush administration does not really want to accept, that is, accepting, granting more sovereign rights to the Iraqi government.
Do you think that Senator Barack Obama has backed off on his initial rhetoric about Iraq? He has talked about the surge being successful. He hasn't talked as much about Iraq. It was a big part of his campaign not that long ago. Why isn't it now?
Well, you know, for various reasons. I mean, I think more and more Americans now are basically focused on the economy. I mean, the economy now is the biggest elephant in the room.
Yes.
I mean, this is. And secondly, what Senator John McCain and the Bush administration and what I call the policy establishment has been debating now is that the surge has succeeded. There's a decrease in violence in Iraq, substantial decrease. Correct. And that's why it's very difficult for Senator Barack Obama now to argue that the situation in Iraq remains as grim as it was, let's say, a year ago. And that's why he's shifting focus from Iraq into the economy. And also, remember, I mean, this is Senator John McCain and President Bush have been arguing that we are the only one that could be trusted with victory. I mean, they're using rhetoric. I mean, the Democratic Party, unfortunately, has always been vulnerable on this particular question, the question of national security. But the truth is, truly, regardless of whether you support Senator Barack Obama or John McCain, both Senator John McCain and the Bush administration are now coming closer to the position of Senator Barack Obama, which has been consistent over the last 2 years, extracting American forces over a long period, that is between 16 months and 2 years. And in fact, the Iraqi Prime Minister, al-Maliki, he himself, who was put in place by the Bush administration, basically agreed with Senator Obama, as you know, and said, yes, we need a timetable. A timetable serves both the interests of the United States and the Iraqi people as well.
We have a lot of people who would like to speak with you, Fawaz, and we will take phone calls in just a moment. Professor Fawaz Jurjis is our guest. He is the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. He has written a number of books, including Journey of the Jihadist, Inside Muslim Militancy, The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global, and he is currently at work and has been spending a lot of time talking with people in the Middle East, activists and militants, in preparation for his next book. Our phone number, one line is open if you'd like to take it right now. It's yours, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Brian Greene will be joining us. He's been here before talking about his books, The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos, professor of physics and math at Columbia University. And his latest book is for all ages. It's Icarus at the Edge of Time, which talks about black holes. Brian Greene with us, hour number two. Let's go to phone calls now, and we start with Bill from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Another great program. Professor, I read in a July 2007 New York Times article that 6 months after the initial surge, that internal displacement in Iraq had increased dramatically. I was wondering if you could shed some light on that. And Kathleen, if you'd allow me, I do have a closely related follow-up question.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your question, because I think when I mentioned that the situation in Iraq remains very fragile, I should have really explained further what I mean by fragility. It's not just you have 500 Iraqi civilians who have been killed, who are being killed on a monthly basis. It's not that Baghdad now is ethnically cleansed. What I mean by ethnically cleansed is that Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds now live in separate compartments. Iraq used to be one of the most integrated ethnic and society. What I didn't mention, Kathleen, you have 2 million Iraqi refugees internally displaced inside Iraq itself. You have more than 3 million Iraqi refugees who live between Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and other countries as well. Their situation is highly serious, both economically and socially. In fact, some Iraqi families have been sending their girls in order to provide money for the family, sending their girls to serve as prostitutes in some places in Jordan and Syria. And this tells you about the intensity and the gravity of the social situation, not just the political crisis that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Bill, carry on.
So, I know that the Iraqi forces are, I don't know, perhaps they are not. Are they acting more militarily? And if so, I mean, are these brigades at least integrated, or we just have Sunni and Shiite brigades perhaps not acting in the best interest of the country, but just then in the best interest of their religious sect? And I'll take the rest off the air. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Bill.
Bill, another great question. When I said that the central government in Baghdad is a sectarian-based government, I meant it literally. Kathleen, more than 70% of the Iraqi security services are Shia, as opposed to Sunnis. The Shias in Iraq represent about 60% of the population, and the Sunni Arabs about 20% of the population. The so-called awakening councils that have been basically chasing Al-Qaeda out of Iraq, the United States has been paying the salaries of those, you might say, freelance fighters. And the U.S. has been urging the Iraqi government to integrate those 120,000 or 100,000 Sunni Arabs into the security government. And the Iraqi government, even today, has opposed the integration, the absorption, of those so-called 120,000 Iraqi Sunnis. In fact, they agreed to take about 15 or 20%, and the rest to serve in various civilian positions. Because, again, what this tells you about how deep the sectarian line divide is in Iraq today. How can you talk about a unified state? How can you talk about democracy when the central government itself is a sectarian-based government, when the Sunni Arabs deep extremely alienated and estranged from the government itself? And this is why American commanders, more than we do, they realize how fragile the situation. And they realize, unless a national unity government is established, unless the security forces are fully integrated, the various communities, Iraq will likely remain fragile. In fact, I would argue that both the surge and the so-called the revolt by Sunni Arabs are short-term mechanics that basically obscure the simmering fault lines under the surface, and we should not be surprised after President Bush leaves the office that somehow a major explosion, the fault lines that are simmering under the surface explode and plunge Iraq into a greater crisis than it is in today.
Professor Georgis, is there something that can be done to deal with that sectarian divide?
Absolutely. I think what the United States needs to realize that the Iraqi communities themselves basically must be in charge. That as long as the United States remains in Iraq, I think the United States is postponing the inevitable. The inevitable being basically a new Iraqi government structured along national unity lines rather than ethnic and tribal lines. And this is only the Iraqis with the support of the international community, including the United States, would be able to help Iraqis. But you see, as long as you have 140,000 American troops, as long as the American forces are basically maintaining or keeping or sustaining the sectarian-based order in Iraq, why should Maliki, why should the Shia-based government make the concessions that are needed to basically overcome the sectarian and tribal divide that exists in Iraq today?
Joe from Oconomowoc, our next caller. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. I find this very, very intriguing, to the point that I'm delaying going into my office.
Your
guest is so knowledgeable, and I compliment him. I have two questions, and one is picks up right where he was, and another is a very simple banking question. The first question is, based on these terribly divided ethnic divisions in Iraq, which reminds me so much of the Kosovo situation we dealt with, 10 years ago. I don't understand how the current delineation of Iraq as a nation state that was drawn by the British government in the aftermath of the War of 1918 can continue. And there seems to be a blind adherence by the Western powers, including our own, to this artificial conglomeration of the Kurds, the Sunnis, the Shiites of the Iraqi area. And it just seems to me, from an overview, that these have to be separated out into regions that can work on autonomy within itself rather than try to kill the other faction for control of the whole. And maybe I can get a comment on that first. And my second question is, what about the $73 billion in the Bank of New York of the oil revenues, and can we use that money to defray some of the expenditures rather than the American taxpayers? Those are my two questions.
Thank you very much. Good questions, Joe.
Thank you. On the first question, I don't think really it's our responsibility to basically play empire and try to suggest that Iraq should be split or divided into either two states or three states. Once we venture into this particular scheme, we are really playing God and playing empire, in particular since our really invasion and occupation of Iraq has unleashed basically those fault lines that are manifesting themselves on the Iraqi streets today. I feel in the last 3 years or so that there has been a surge of what I call Iraqi nationalism. And Iraqi nationalism as a force, both against the American-led invasion and occupation of Iraq, and also against the vicious attacks by Al-Qaeda. And I'm becoming more hopeful that the rise of Iraqi nationalism would basically help to overcome the sectarian and the ethnic divide that exists today in Iraq. And I'm hoping also that once the United States sets a timetable for pulling out its forces out of Iraq and making it very clear that the United States does not really have any designs on maintaining military bases in Iraq, I would hope that this nationalism, this unity-based nationalism, would basically overcome the diversive forces that are tearing the very social fabric of Iraq apart. On the second question, yes, the Iraqi government has about $75 or $80 billion in reserve today. But what we need to understand here is that no one now, even the Iraqi government, wants the United States to basically set a speedy timetable for extracting its forces out of Iraq. So the question is not whether the Iraqi government should spend its money or not. It should. It
should spend its money. I just mentioned there are about 4 million Iraqi refugees internally and externally. I would like to see some of those billions helping those Iraqis to resettle in Iraq, to provide them with security and economic stability. But I also would like, instead of really hammering this particular question about what the Iraqi government would do, why shouldn't we set a timetable, bring our forces out of Iraq in the next 16 or 17 months, as Senator Barack Obama has been saying, and basically get rid of this high bill of almost $10 billion we are spending in Iraq every month.
And what you hear in response to that is we couldn't do that now because the government is still fragile. It needs our guidance or whatever you want to call it. And if we withdrew, the sectarian divide would be even worse. The country would descend into more chaos, and we can't let that happen.
Well, Kathleen, the Iraqi government itself now it's saying, the Iraqi government, an overwhelming majority of Iraqi public opinion. Let me mention here a few footnotes to your listeners. According to local polls taken in Iraq, almost 90%, Kathleen, 90% of Iraqi public opinion, including Shia and Sunni, would like the United States to leave Iraq. According to a major BBC poll, almost 70% of Iraqi public opinion would like the United States to leave Iraq. The Iraqi government, the Iraqi authorities, the Iraqi political class would like the United States to set a timetable, a speedy timetable. So it seems to me, after all, if we really went to Iraq to help Iraqis construct a viable democracy, I think we should be listening to what the Iraqi public opinion would like us to do, unless we are really an occupying force, unless we really have, different designs on the country and we don't give a damn what the Iraqi political class or public opinion would like us to do. And I think the administration itself says that the situation has improved considerably. So why not set a timetable over the next 18 or 16 months as the Iraqi government and as Senator Barack Obama has been making the case, in particular Senator Barack Obama, in the last 2 years.
Professor Fawaz Jurgis is our guest, and he holds the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs, Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. You see him regularly on CNN, CBS, NPR, BBC, and Al Jazeera, and he's a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. He is the author. One of his books will be, his latest book will be out soon, and he has written Journey of the Jihadist, Inside Muslim Militancy and the Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global. We'll get to Pakistan sometime too before we say goodbye to him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We thank you, Joe, for your call, and go to Habu from Madison. Hi.
Good morning and thank you. Just a couple of comments about what has been said so far by callers. I think it's almost shameful that politicians in this country would cry about the 75 or 80 billion that Iraq has accumulated from the oil revenues for a country that believes in the rule of law. When a country occupies another, it is the duty of the occupying country to provide for the smooth running of the government and the people's needs and the economy, etc. So that is not our money to even look to covet, but we should be providing for it from our coffers. And the way that the U.S. has done it has been very inadequate, and it's been given to choice contributors to political campaigns, etc. My question, and the second part is that this whole notion of dividing a country up is really sounds so obscene. And is it any? It seems like we're seeing it now in Bolivia, and also in Darfur and Kosovo, wherever the U.S. is is involved. So there must be some kind of a grand scheme here. But my question to the good guest is, the whole notion of this status of forces agreement has been leaked by a number of people, but Raya Jarar, who's going to be talking here in Madison today. But in it, he points out how the Iraqi administration is so corrupt and so so prostrate that they dare not put it to the vote of the Iraqi parliament, let alone the Iraqi people. And this is the same thing with the oil agreement, too. And would you kind of expound on that, please? And thank you.
Thank you. I mean, I think on the question of resources, and I also want to add one footnote to Joe's question. What we need to remember, Kathleen, is that, yes, we have spent about $1 trillion on the war. But remember, the overwhelming percent of the $1 trillion was spent on fighting the war itself. A very small fraction has been spent on the so-called the social and economic reconstruction, and most of the money spent on the social and economic reconstruction basically has been swept by corruption. I mean, it's one of the most corrupt, according to UN figures, Iraq now, and the political class in Iraq, one of the most corrupt classes in the world, thanks to the infusion, billions of dollars. So the money, the $1 trillion, has not been spent to reconstruct state and society in Iraq, has been spent in order to fight the war against al-Qaeda and the armed insurgency. The second point about the status of agreement. I mentioned that I made it very clear, I hope, that according to local polls, 90% of Iraqis would like the United States to leave Iraq as soon as possible. And in fact, there is a consensus within the political class that the United States should leave Iraq. And that's why the so-called the Status of Forces Agreement, the Maliki government, in fact, the Maliki government who was put in place by the Bush administration, was basically has positioned himself, because there are elections coming soon, local elections, because he realizes the power of public opinion, that now he is the one who's saying that we need the United States to set a timetable, but he was really forced, his hands was forced by public opinion, and there he and the sectarian-based government to take the status of agreement to the parliament, because it will not, it will be voted down, because the parliament want the United States not only to set a timetable for extracting its forces out of Iraq, but the sooner the better. What I mean by the sooner, in the next year or so, rather than in 3 or 4 years.
Professor Fawaz Jirj is our guest. We're talking about Iraq. We will move into Pakistan in the last part of this program. And welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Brian Green will be with us, known for a number of groundbreaking discoveries in superstring theory. He's chaired the first annual World Science Festival last May, a gathering of the world's leading scientists. And his latest book is Icarus at the Edge of Time, which brings the topic of black holes into a dimension that we can understand. Brian Green with us, the second hour of our program. Professor Fawaz Jirjis is here now. He is the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College, has written a number of books about the Middle East, and is currently compiling all of the interviews that he has done with activists and militants, and his book should be finished. We'll hold him to this by the end of this fall. Back to phone calls. Let's go to Ken from Vilas County. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Hi.
Well, the comment that I had to make, talking about this timetable withdrawal from Iraq, I think as some of our generals over there that are running the war, that'd be about the most ridiculous thing that we could do. Now, even though some of the, well, you talk about the 90% or something of the people want us out, I think the Iraqi government knows better. They know what a fragile situation this is over there now. And seeing the success that we have made under General Petraeus, and he has also stated that it would be devastating that we would up and pull out, why, I think that if we follow what we've been doing, why, that's going to lead to victory over there and success for the Iraqi people. And we talk about withdrawal. Why are we still sitting over in Korea in some of these places? That, if they want to withdraw, why, I would say pull some of these troops out of there. and your guest mentioned this is a plan that Barack Obama come up with. Well, here's a guy that's been over there once. He never even as much as visited the generals or the troops, and he's got all the ideas on everything. Well, I think that taking any recommendation from him is about like listening to the wind. He has no experience, doesn't know what's going on, and all he's doing is going on public opinion is what people thinks we should do. I think this is something where we'd ought to be listening to the generals over there, not politicians.
Okay, thanks for the call, Ken. Professor Georges.
Well, I mean, I think the caller touched on a very critical point, Kathleen, and that's the Korean model, the World War II model. And really, this lies at the heart of what Senator John McCain and the neoconservatives have in mind. That is really, we are in Iraq to stay for half a century. This is really when Senator McCain uttered the word 100 years, I'm not going to hold it against him, but what he really means is that we really are in Iraq in order to really basically win, quote-unquote, to have a victory. And they have not defined for us what victory is. A victory against whom in Iraq? Because the crisis, in essence, is political. The Iraqi communities differ substantially on the future of Iraq. And I think what the caller has said and what your listeners should understand is that there are two paradigms here. One paradigm advanced by Senator John McCain and the neoconservatives that we're going to stay in Iraq for half a century in the same way that we have stayed in Korea and other places in Europe. And you can imagine if we're paying $10 billion a month here, I mean, count the billions and the trillions. If we stay for the next 5 or 6 years, it's going to be about $3 trillion. Can our economy afford to wage multiple wars throughout the world? What would be the implications? And the question is, there is no victory. You're not facing here enemies. This is an internal, a complex internal situation. The second model, Kathleen, is the following. It was a strategic blunder from day one. And it was and is a strategic blunder. How do we help the Iraqi government and the Iraqi communities reach a political settlement? And we do so by impressing on the Iraqi government that we are not there to stay forever. We have a moral obligation to give them a deadline, as the Iraqis would like us to do. The gentleman does not take into account the wishes of the Iraqi people. What he's really talking about is imperialism. We're going to stay in Iraq against the wishes of the Iraqi public opinion, Arab and Muslim public opinion, and the political class. And then you've got to turn the entire Iraqi society against you. This will be a war between an occupying power and the Iraqi people. The second paradigm, I would argue, is a more rational, more reasonable, and I would argue has the potential to attain victory. Not victory against imagined enemies, but rather to help the Iraqi communities reach a political settlement, the creation of a national unity government based not on sectarianism, but on a higher and greater goal and purpose.
Mm-hmm. Can we spend, before we go back to phone calls, just a few moments on Pakistan? The military yesterday saying troops would fire on foreign forces if they crossed the country's borders. The comments after U.S. sent commandos into Pakistan to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda. What's going on here?
Well, you know, Kathleen, since we're talking about Iraq, and again, the debate, we have been distracted in the last a few weeks or not. The question that many commentators are asking, and not asking, why the situation has deteriorated so dramatically in both Afghanistan and Pakistan? This is the question. The question is that the implications, the reverberations of the Iraq war have done a great deal of damage to the theaters in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The reason why the Taliban in both Afghanistan and Pakistan have basically surged is a result of basically the diversion of American forces and also the result of what I call the creation of the Iraqi model, the migration of the suicide model from Iraq as a result of the American-led invasion, occupation of Iraq to Afghanistan and Pakistan. I would argue, Kathleen, and this is the point I want to make today, and I'm
I might prove to be wrong. I have been proven to be wrong many times. That is, another strategic mistake and blunder we're making in Afghanistan and Pakistan is to lump together the Pashtun tribes, the Taliban and the Pashtun tribes, both in Afghanistan and Pakistan, with Al-Qaeda, to lump them together and wage a military-based war against them, as we have been doing. In fact, this is the worst case, because if we do lump the Pashtun tribes who are fighting the so-called foreigners in both Pakistan and the tribal areas in Pakistan, I think we would find ourselves bogged down in both Afghanistan and Pakistan in a very prolonged war. I would argue a bloodier war than the war in Iraq itself. Again, I talked about public opinion in Iraq. An overwhelming majority of Pakistanis basically would like the foreigners out, the foreigners meaning we, the United States, and the European forces. And the big point to highlight here, we cannot just throw military might at a highly complex situation. Our strategy should be to engineer a political settlement whereby the Pashtun tribes in both Afghanistan and Pakistan chase out Al-Qaeda and the foreign fighters, foreign militants, in the same way that the Sunni tribes in Iraq help to chase out Al-Qaeda militants and terrorists out of Iraq. A political settlement based on investing in the political economy of both Pakistan, the tribal areas in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and also a regional settlement that takes into account Pakistan and India's and Iran and Afghanistan regional concerns and interests. This is a highly complex situation. The way we're going about it now is to basically tell the American people that this is a war against Al-Qaeda. This is not a war against Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Kathleen, represents a very, very tiny element. That is, I'm talking about a few hundreds. The big question, the big problem are the Pashtun tribes who are basically represented by the Taliban. And that's why a settlement, a political settlement, a political economy settlement, a regional settlement will basically go a long way to addressing this major crisis in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And here I fear, Kathleen, that Senator Barack Obama and Senator McCain have similar positions. They think that somehow by sending more troops to Pakistan and Afghanistan would basically defeat the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. In fact, I would argue sending more troops would basically get the United States to be bogged down in a very prolonged war, unwinnable wars, with as many casualties as we have lost in Iraq, if not more so.
You know, I would say that you have not proven to be wrong that often, which is why we have you on. If you look at your track record with us, you've been right on almost everything, Professor Georges.
I'm just trying to really add a footnote that we are speculating a great deal.
Right.
And this is a debate that we should have some humility, really all of us.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about, when we say victory here and there, this is not just about victory for the United States. This is about really finding a way out of the bottleneck that we have found ourselves in the last 5 years, thanks to the strategic blunders perpetrated by the so-called neoconservatives in Iraq and elsewhere as well.
Yeah. One more phone call. We're almost out of time, and it's from Ken from La Crosse. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, you?
Doing well. Thanks for taking my call. I did want to ask your guest one question concerning our upcoming presidential election. Could you give your best guess on, you know, both administrations under a Obama Biden administration versus McCain administration? How are we going to look in the next, say, 2 years from now in Iraq as far as American participation under those two administrations? What are the differences, or what do you see, their goals being separately? Because I think this has a lot to do with, as voters look at making their choice, who they're going to support.
We have about a minute, Fawaz.
Well, as we know, Senator John McCain basically believes in using the American military in a very promiscuous way. I fear that with Senator McCain, the United States would likely be bogged down in multiple wars. The Iraq War, a greater war in Afghanistan and probably Pakistan, and a Cold War with Russia itself. And I fear those multiple wars would take their toll, not just on American economy, but American society and America's status in the world. I think with Senator Barack Obama as president, you would see the United States basically with a different vision, a different image in the world, with a track, a framework to extract American forces out of Iraq. I think you would see an Obama administration putting a great deal of emphasis on diplomacy and politics, on investments, on partnership. I mean, I think what distinguishes both candidates here, Senator Barack Obama, he talks about partnership with the international community. That is a return to what I call the realist approach in foreign policy. With Senator McCain, I fear not only more of the same, I would argue, I dread multiple wars and being bogged down in multiple theaters with tremendous, tremendous cost.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Professor Georges, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Fawaz Georges, he is the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program.